sellers all at once, because if they ever decide to cash in or do something else, it could be quite disastrous for the grain market.
Thank you much, Kurt.
Very good. Take care.
That's Kurt Kimmel of Bates Commodities, and he is in Normal, Illinois. Jay, I think we're about a phone away, five phone calls or thereabouts of meeting a $1,000 challenge now.
We need you to be bullish on Will Ag at 217-244-9455. Call and say, I support WILL Agriculture. Here's $10 a month. I'm going to put it on my credit card. Or you can log on to willag.org, like Gary Collins and Brenda Collins from Flanagan, and Marianne Alexander from Champaign, Bill Brummel of Pontiac, Jerry Harlow at Tipton, Indiana, and Kathleen Allison of Leroy, Illinois. Just some of the more than 150 people who have called in support of WILL Agriculture. We're just a few phone calls away from meeting a $1,000 challenge from First National Bank of Clinton this morning. We want to thank all of you who have called, but we can't leave that $1,000 on the table. We need your call, your pledge right now, 217-244-9455. Make a $52 pledge or a $120 pledge at 244-9455 or willpledge.org. And thanks.
And remember, as long as you continue to dial right now, when we count down those ag pledges, I'll throw that $300 in. 217-244-9455 is the number to call. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. In the studio, Focus host David Inge.
Hi, Dave.
What do you have today, sir?
Well, we're very happy to have here on the program one of our favorite guests, May Barenbaum, is here. She's an entomologist, a scientist who specializes in studying insects. And from time to time, she's on the show, and that's what we do. And in recent years, one of the things we spent a lot of time talking about bees and a particular problem that bees have been having. Maybe a little news to offer on that, but something really special that we have this morning that we will use to encourage people to support the station. We have a brand new cookbook that is just out. It's published by the University of Illinois Press, and it's a collection of recipes that May has edited, and they all use honey. So we're encouraging people to support the station this morning, and if you do that, we would send you with our thanks a copy of the book. We'll talk more about that in a moment. Also, our number two, Mike Ward, is going to be here. He is assistant professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences at the U of I. He's also an avian ecologist. We'll talk about fall bird migration and also bird watching. So this morning, it's the birds and the bees on Focus.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. It's our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And as I said, we're really happy to have back here on the program once again May Barenbaum. She's the head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I and is a scientist who specializes in studying insects. And we talk with her. We generally have her here a couple times during the year, particularly in the summer, times when insects are most active. And we're very happy here now in the fall, when we usually don't see her, to have her on the program to talk about a new book, which she has edited, that's just out from the University of Illinois Press. And it's called Honey, I'm Homemade. And that's May Barenbaum 100% there. It's a collection of recipes that all use honey. And also, it has some information here about bees and how they make honey and why bees are special and why we should take care of them. And so the book is out now. It's in the bookstore. But particularly this morning, we're hoping that people will support Focus and will support this station by making a pledge of $75. And if you do that, with our thanks, we will send you a copy of the book, Honey, I'm Homemade. And May says that she will autograph them.
Personalize
them. So we're doing that. But there's something else here that she offered to do that I think is really special and really cool. So make the offer.
Well, this cookbook was – I didn't put this cookbook together because I'm so well known as a master of culinary arts, but because we have a project. Our department has converted what was once a pesticide storage shed into a science center devoted to pollinators and pollination, and it's free and open to the public. We actually opened last year. We've had over 2,000 visitors. We have every second grade class from the Champaign schools coming. And we have no budget. So I thought maybe we could raise some funds. And I just put this I couldn't sleep one night in August, so I started writing about honey. I'd actually taught a course on honey here at the university, a discovery course in the spring. It was just so fascinating. So my husband had a 95-year-old cousin who, over her all 95 years, collected recipes, cookbooks, and the like. She donated a portion of her 3,000-volume cookbook collection to the university library, but she donated thousands of handwritten, hand-notated recipe pages to my daughter, who likes baking as well. So I started looking through those recipes and found a bunch with honey, and I thought, oh, I could put together a honey cookbook. And that was the nucleus. And then I started asking around the department. And you know, we have a very international department. And the nice thing about a honey cookbook is Apis mellifera, the Western honeybee, is essentially the world's only managed pollinator. So Apis mellifera is everywhere in the world, and honey from made by Apis mellifera shows up in recipes from around the world. So from our former students and postdocs all over the world, I started getting recipes, and then I went through our departmental archive and found the notes from our first apiculture professor, Vern Milam, who was hired in 1921 to teach bees and beekeeping. And he, as part of his job, had assembled recipes throughout the years. Then I went through the Illinois State Beekeepers Association archive and found the winning recipes from the Illinois State Fair Culinary Honey Competition. So, you know, there's cooking competition every year, and there used to be a honey category. Mm-hmm. So I have to say they're only dessert recipes because I'm like bees, I'm a vegetarian. And I had no way of assessing anything involving meat. So I just wanted to stay away from those. And yeah, salad, I don't know, didn't sound nearly as much fun as dessert. So it's the subtitle of the book is Sweet Treats from the Beehive Across the Centuries and Around the World. So 100% of the proceeds go to support the pollinatarium. And that's, you know, it's, I think it's appropriate because bees make honey by collecting nectar from all kinds of flowers. I made a cookbook by collecting recipes from all kinds of sources. And it, you know, these practice altruism, unselfish behavior because they're social species. And really, this is not, nobody who knows me in the kitchen would think Maeve Arenbaum and cookbook belong in the same sentence. I'm very grateful to the University of Illinois Press because they actually had a cookbook editor go through this, and I had no idea that there was a set format for publishing recipes, and I had committed a number of culinary faux pas in cobbling together this book, so it's much, much improved. And the illustrations, by the way, are from one of our recent students, Nils Cordes, who's just a brilliant artist and cartoonist, and I think the drawings are appropriately whimsical. You can see the cover is a honeybee with a chef's hat. So,
All right. So that's the deal here. You can get a copy of the book, and Maeve will sign it for you. Honey, I'm Homemade, this new collection of honey recipes that benefits the pollinatarium on the U of I campus. It's published by the U of I Press, and $75 pledge at 244-9455. 217 area code, or you can go online, willpledge.org. And even more special, and if that's not enough, ladies and gentlemen, don't you think it ought to be? $250, you're saying, if someone would make a pledge that size, you would give them a personal tour of the pollinatarium.
Yes, you can see the behind the scenes at the pollinatarium. I think it's a wonderful collection. We have exhibits and panels dealing with every kind of pollinator, not just insect pollinators, although I'm biased. There's some 200,000 species of pollinators that assist plants and, you know, partner with flowering plants to promote the reproduction. Maybe 1,000 vertebrates, and the rest are invertebrates, insects. So we have a beehive, a functioning working beehive. You can see the queen and her retinue and see the bees doing their their dances to alert other foragers to where nectar sources are. We have a collection of historical beekeeping equipment. So you can see the straw woven skeps and some clay skeps from the 100 years ago, actually. We have exhibits on contemporary beekeeping, modern equipment. We have drawers full of all kinds of pollinators and there are interactive games for kids. There are displays, just all kinds of things to do there. So I'm happy to, at your convenience, to take you there and answer any questions you might have and show you around.
Where else are you going to have an opportunity like this? Nowhere else, that's what I say. So if you want to call in and make a pledge, it would really help us a lot. We're here in our fall fundraising effort. This is the money that we'll pay for next year's programs, this and everything else that you listen to on the station. So we hope that if you haven't yet done it, you take the opportunity to call or go online, make a pledge. Now, also, of course, as usual, if you have a question, an insect-related question, as long as it's not extermination, you are certainly welcome to call and talk with May. And that number, as same as always, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu.
And I'm also happy to answer any questions people might have about bees and colony collapse disorder and honey and how it's used around the world and why it's such a highly desirable commodity and what the kosher laws are about honey. And I mean, it's really a fascinating subject, I think.
You probably knew stuff about honey before, but probably as a result of doing this, did you actually learn things about honey that you had not known before?
Well, I've actually worked on honey. In the mid-90s, I was annoyed by reports in the nutrition literature equated honey with sugar sugar water, and basically arguing that honey enjoyed a reputation for healthfulness that it didn't deserve. And I thought this notion that it's just sugar water is nonsense, because nectar is a plant tissue and it contains all the phytochemicals that other plant tissues contain. So those are all, for the most part, biologically active. If you know honeys, you know that their different floral sources make honeys different colors, different tastes, different odors. And in fact, a beehive has multiple combs, and the honey in one comb can look, taste, and feel different from the honey in a neighboring comb, because it all depends on the floral nectars that go in. So since I knew a lot of the constituents of honey include the phenolics that are common plant chemicals that have antioxidant properties, we measured the antioxidant contents of about 14 different varietal honeys that are from primarily one floral source. We found 20-fold variation in the antioxidant content. And at the high end, buckwheat honey had about the same antioxidant content as broccoli, which is like supposed to be really good for you, but honey tastes a whole lot better than broccoli, and yet has many of the same health benefits. Antioxidants are supposed to promote longevity, antioxidants prevent the oxidation of important biomolecules that result from aging and from ultraviolet light and all kinds of other environmental insults. So honey it's antimicrobial. It is it has remarkable preservative properties. You can eat honey that's hundreds of years old, and as long as no water gets in, it remains unchanged. It's really a miracle food.
I think I probably only got clued to this maybe a few years ago. As I'm sure that growing up, like a lot of people, honey was, you go to the store, and in that section there's a thing that just says honey. And maybe it looks comes in a little plastic container. It looks like a bear, one of those. So and it was sort of all the same, and it was, nothing that really excited me. But then I had some honey that came from one of our area producers here locally in the area, and it was Tupelo. And I thought, okay, now you're talking about something here, though. I thought, whoa, this is – it was very interesting, very complex. There was a lot of stuff going on, and, basically beat the pants off your average clover honey. Not that there's really anything wrong with that, but that gets at this idea that – and then I think I tried some that was orange blossom. And it tasted like orange and wildflower. And it had this very deep, dark, interesting thing going on here. And that says that, well, every different thing that the nectar comes from has something special that hooks it to where it came from. So, yeah, orange blossom honey tastes like orange. And the Tupelo has this really interesting sort of cinnamon thing going in it. And I thought, whoa, how long has this been going on? Why was I not informed? So I think people really ought to try different kinds of honeys just to see how special this thing is.
Yeah, they're now enjoying – the varietal honeys are enjoying sort of a new popularity along with artisanal breads and artisanal cheeses and the like. But honey is really the flavor of a particular time and place, and it's different every jar. The reason it all tastes the same in the grocery store is that the big honey suppliers blend it so it's all the same color and it's all the same flavor, mostly clover because that's what Americans are used to. But if you go to local producers, then you see what tremendous variety there is. And they have different properties. And one reason people like to cook with honey is that there is this tremendous diversity. It's also a reason people don't like to cook with honey because nothing tastes the same twice if you use different honey. Mm-hmm. And then honey also has such a powerful taste that whatever you make, if it has a lot of honey in it, becomes honey. Honey brownies, honey chocolate cake, honey, you know, because you can – honey cookies. You can tell the honey's in there. But by the same token, honey beats sugar, sucrose, table sugar, hands down in so many different ways. Baked items stay fresher longer with honey because honey – what bees do to make honey out of nectar is evaporate out the water. So they reduce it from 80 to 90% water to about 18% water. So that's one reason that honey – doesn't promote the growth of microbes. There's not enough water in there to support microbial growth. It's also why baked goods with honey stay moist because the honey is hygroscopic. Since it has had so much water driven out, it actually sucks out atmospheric water. Mm-hmm. So it remains – honey baked goods don't dry out quite so quickly. So commercial bakers love honey.
We have several callers here. May Barenbaum is our guest. She is head of the Department of Entomology, chairs Department of Entomology here at the U of I. She's a scientist who specializes in studying insects and has been with us many times to talk about them. She is, of course, the person behind the now internationally famous Insect Fear Film Festival. It's been happening now how many years now?
2011 is our 28th year.
28th year next year. And she also is the editor of a new book that is a collection of recipes, all recipes that use honey. Also in here, you can read some things about bees and how they make honey and something of the how people over time have thought about it and used it and about how going back a very long time in human history, people have thought honey was something really special. And by the way, if you call in with a pledge this morning at the $75 level, we'll have you put into your hands an autographed copy of the book, Honey, I'm Homemade, edited by May. And it's published by the University of Illinois Press. All right, let's talk with some folks here. We're somebody on a cell phone on the road. Line number 4, hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, I've got a couple of questions. One is pretty seasonal, and the other is just a general question. The use of honeycomb honey, you know what I mean? That it contains honeycomb with it.
Yep.
Anecdotally and as a measure of or as an indication of some folklore, we talk about using that type of honey for allergies because it's got a lot more pollen in it that you kind of like stimulate or overstimulate your immune system to try to prevent like allergies, you know, from hay fever and that kind of stuff. The indication for that, for using it for that, is that indeed a basis in fact? And number two, what do you do about these Asian lady beetles? Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first question first. That is the number one question I'm asked whenever I talk about honey. I have to say I know of no scientific study that shows that consuming local honey or honeycomb honey helps to reduce allergies to pollen. And mechanistically, it's kind of puzzling as to why it would, because the pollen that's in honey tends to be the pollen that the honeybees collect, which comes from plants that are insect pollinated. Plants that are insect pollinated tend to keep their pollen in place rather than release it to the wind. That way their animal partners can pick it up. So the allergies that we develop tend to be to wind-blown pollen, to plants that produce pollen that is disseminated by wind rather than by animals. So ragweed is a wind-pollinated plant. I'm allergic to corn pollen, and then corn is a wind-pollinated plant. So unless the protein composition of animal-pollinated and wind-pollinated plants is very similar, then I'm not sure how bee-collected pollen would help ameliorate allergies. That said, I don't know of any studies to the contrary either. I just don't know of any scientific studies. But in terms of the medicinal value of honey, it is abundantly clear that honey is antimicrobial, and how antimicrobial depends on the floral sources. And just a couple of years ago, the Food and Drug Administration approved the use of Manuka honey. This is a bush that grows in New Zealand. For treatment of MRSA, the methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus bacterium, the flesh-eating bacterium, it turns out that the Manuka honey has a component that is extremely effective against these antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and wound dressings that are impregnated with Manuka honey are now approved by the FDA. So again, the constituents vary depending on the nectar inputs, but there's a long, long, long history of honey use medicinally for treating ulcers and for treating wounds and for treating cataracts. And because it's so biologically active, there's likely to be something to it.
Why don't we hold off on Asian lady beetles?
Oh, right.
And I tell you what, we have another person here who's on the phone, and let's get them rather than make them wait. This is a caller from Indiana, line one. Hello.
Hello. Well,
yeah.
It works out. One of the things I was going to ask was about lady bugs, which are everywhere.
Yep.
The last time you were on the radio, it was the butterflies, and you were talking to some extent about why there were so many butterflies this year, and I to add my balcony, and I saw on the ladybugs, just, you know, it looked like a movie with airplanes landing. They're everywhere, and they do some very strange fly patterns I got to see. But my question basically was, if you could give us some idea, perhaps maybe it would be a good example, of the amount of energy used to do all this flying and what it takes to do it. I'm constantly amazed by spiders I get to see that seem to go on forever without any kind of ingestion of food at all, because their webs simply don't have any insects in them, but they continue to repair the webs when the wind gets high and things like that. If you could speak to that in some general way, that's what I'd like to hear about. Thanks.
All right.
Pleasure. I'll get to ladybugs, honest to gosh. There's some... These are the sorts of statistics that entomologists love. I know they're in here. But honey is very dilute, and each individual flower contains only a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of honey. So it, you know, one reason people think bees are busy is that it really does take an enormous amount of effort to make honey. So basically, a kilo of honey, 2.2 pounds, one load of nectar to fill the bee's honey stomach requires potentially up to 1,000 different flowers. So the 2.2 pounds of honey result from 100,000 loads of nectar. So that's a visit to as many as 10 million flowers. And depending on how far apart those flowers are, visiting those 10 million flowers could necessitate flying up to 240,000 miles, which is 10 times the circumnavigation of the Earth, 10 times the distance around the equator, going into just 2.2 pounds of honey. So it's enormously energy-consumptive process. It requires a mind-boggling amount of work on the part of the bees. That another thing that makes it so precious, I think, is a lot of work went into it.
The first caller, I think he was just probably maybe has a lot of them in his house and was wondering what to do.
Asian lady beetles.
But the second caller, you know, it does make me think about the fact that here you could, if you just sort of left them alone, they pretty much hang out in your house all winter long, and you wonder, well, what are they eating? And I guess the answer is they're not.
This is the many ladybugs. go into what entomologists call diapause during the winter months, you could think of it as hibernation. And just like bears, well, they're not exactly like bears, but bears go and sleep basically throughout the winter. They don't feed. They bulk up on fats and live off their stored fats. Well, that's what the ladybugs are doing as well. They undergo a reproductive diapause. So they basically they become adults, and then when the weather gets cold, they look for shelter. And as we've said on the show a number of times, you could probably do it with me. They're from Asia, and typically they like to overwinter in vertical cliff faces, in cracks and crevices and vertical cliff faces. And we don't have too many of those in central Illinois, so the closest approximation is somebody's the side of somebody's house. And one reason they aggregate during the winter, whether you get all of them all at once in one place, is that aggregation appears to help them regulate their body temperature and their water loss. So in a big mass like that, they tend not to dry out so quickly, which is a big risk during the winter, during the dry winter months. So that why they're so abundant this year is highly likely because soybean, you know, their abundance tends to follow the soybean aphid abundance.
And last year we had a bunch of soybean aphids.
In fact, I think were I on the show last year, it would have been, what are those things flying?
Yeah.
And, you know, people couldn't ride their bikes on campus because they were so abundant. So Asian multicolored ladybug is a very omnivorous carnivore. It feeds on just about anything it can catch that's slower and softer than it is. But they're particularly fond of aphids. And the soybean aphid grows in such abundance that it's not surprising that it supports very large populations of multicolored Asian ladybug. So in some ways, people hate the ladybug. I mean, it has ruined all the centuries of good publicity that ladybugs have enjoyed. And, you know, it bites, it smells bad, and, you know, it actually ecologists don't like it because it's so generalized. It eats anything small and soft-bodied, including caterpillars of monarch butterflies and non-economically important aphids. It just eats everything in its path. It eats other ladybugs, actually the larvae of other ladybugs. So wherever Asian multicolored ladybugs are abundant, our native ladybugs have taken a hit. But that said, it does a number on soybean aphids, which makes soybean growers happy.
We're at a midpoint here. May Barenbaum is our guest, and we're talking about insects, something that we do when she's on the program. And in particular, we're talking about bees and honey. And she is the editor of a newly published book. It's just out from the University of Illinois Press. It's called Honey, I'm Homemade, and it's about bees and honey, and also contains a number of recipes that use honey. And we're saying to folks who are listening this morning, if you would call in with a $75 pledge to support this and other programs you listen to, May will sign a copy and we'll send it to you. So all you have to do is pick up the telephone, go online, and give us a call, make a pledge. Here in studio with me is my boss. He's the general manager of Illinois Public Media. Mark Leonard is his name. And we're here now. This is our fall fundraising effort. We're kind of coming to the end. What do you think about where we are right now?
Well, we're not where we need to be. We've crested 125,000 during this past hour. We've taken 25 calls this hour, but our goal is $175,000. And originally, we were scheduled to wrap up the drive today, but we stand right now short about $50,000. So at this point, we're going to push hard. With your help, we can close the gap, but we do need to raise a lot more than we have so far. Our listeners have said in the past, you know, if you would just tell us, we would step up, we would support, because you don't want to see a cut in our services. Well, we're telling you right now, this is a time to do that. $50,000 in one day is not insurmountable, but it's a big, big number. And the way you can help us out is with a call of support at 244-9455. I'm sitting here just fascinated by the stories of of bees and honey and Asian ladybugs, learning a ton, as I always do on Focus. A bad metaphor comes to mind in terms of pollen and honey. You know, your investment in your station, your pledge, is the pollen that helps us to make the honey, which is part of our overall programming services. And it takes lots and lots of pledges. One pledge doesn't do it, but communally, just like the bees, communally, when you each do your part, we end up with honey, which is the radio service that we provide day in and day out. And I hope that wasn't scientifically offensive.
Oh, the only reason I sort of winced there is that pollen is actually male sex cells, so like sperm.
Let me rephrase that.
So
check your metaphors at the door before you come in here.
It's a layman's metaphor. How's that?
Yeah, it can't take me anywhere. You know?
It's great stuff. Every day you learn a lot. You're stimulated. You're amused. You're entertained. You learn about authors. You learn about science. You learn about the great things that go on in the University of Illinois every single day. And it's what we call Focus. And we're so proud to offer it. We know we have thousands of listeners who rely on the program. This morning we'd like to have thousands of supporters at either 244-9455 or online at willpledge.org.
All right. And remember, for a $75 contribution, you can get a copy of the new book, Honey, I'm Homemade, which contains, among other things, Grandma Berenbaum's challah recipe. And
that was hard won, too, because she never measured anything. So, she could make it. She couldn't even slow down. She made it so quickly. So the only way we could get a recipe, my cousin Lisa stood next to her. So whenever she sort of threw anything into a bowl, my cousin retroactively measured it. So that's the only way we could. And she couldn't slow down to show how to make a 5-strand braid. I still don't know how to do that, but that Grandma Berenbaum's challah recipe, that's really pretty
very rare
precious.
And special. $75, yeah. Folks. And then if people could make a contribution at $250, May says that she will give you a personal tour of the pollinatarium. So now's the time. Give us a call. Go online. We have some other folks to talk with here. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455 with May Berenbaum. And we will talk next with someone in Piatt County, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This year, I live out in the country, and this is the first year I saw the spider in my bathroom, and it seemed to love water, and it ran around, and I can't describe it other than to say it is really big and really black. There, it has no markings, and so apparently it was very happy and proliferated. But the next time I saw it was out in the garage, and there were 5 or 6 of them in litter box. It's like, oh. So I put the litter box outside, but they never left the box. They were just running around. There were so many. We started having so many pure black spiders, and they're big, like a quarter sized. So I'm just curious, since I've never seen them out there before, I just wondered, is this I'm sorry, my description is other than pure black and big.
Well, actually,
description I have.
That's not bad, because black, big, and running are all key words. So it's not a web-building spider. There's a limited number of spiders that run after their prey. Most likely, if it's big, it's a wolf spider. Those are the other lycosidae. These are the big spiders that use their physical strength and speed to sort of overtake their prey. There's, you know, I guess, like the lions of the spider world or something. And why it might be hanging around a litter box, I can only speculate that perhaps that was a rich hunting ground, because if it's not changed very frequently, maybe flies come in or something. So no reflection on the cats or the litter or content of the box, but because they don't spin a web and wait. These are spiders that actively seek out prey and
okay.
run it down.
All right, so I shouldn't do anything to it, or just...
don't pan. I mean, yeah, they are not. I mean, every spider makes venom, but very few spiders in North America either have the jaws or chelicerae strong enough to pierce human skin, or the venom potent enough to cause problems. Mm-hmm. There are some, but unless you have really a sensitivity, wolf spiders really. I mean, they're big enough so that you can't sort of stumble across them by accident. You know. Another question I always get is it true we always spider that over the course of our lives we swallow 30 spiders, you know, during our sleep? That nothing. No, that's totally not true. You couldn't swallow one of these things by accident anyway because
no,
they're huge. So my guess is it's probably a wolf spider. I can't tell you which species, but there is a guide to the spiders of Illinois that might have it in there.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your help.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We'll go back here to someone where we are in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
I was wondering if there's any kind of formula that you can take a recipe that calls for sugar and use honey instead.
Yes, actually there is. Let me make sure I get it right. It's in the cookbook. I have a whole section on how to cook with honey because honey is different from sucrose or table sugar because it's it's a liquid. So if you add it to a recipe, then you're increasing the liquid. It's also sweeter than sucrose. A tablespoon of honey tastes sweeter than a tablespoon of sucrose. So if you're substituting honey for sugar, then you need to cut, you know, it has to be reduced. So the general rule of thumb is 1/4 cup less liquid per cup of honey.
1/4 cup less
liquid per
liquid.
Cup of honey. Yeah. So if you have another liquid in the recipe.
Less liquid for what?
Per cup of honey.
Per cup of honey.
So if there's a recipe with a cup of honey, then cut back on the milk or cut back on any other water or whatever other liquids in the recipe. To deal with the sweetness, use only about 3/4 cup for every cup of sugar. So if you're substituting, you have a cup of sugar in a recipe, use only 3/4 cup of honey.
3/4 cup of honey.
And then one
for,
yeah, for
one cup
of sugar. And then the other thing is honey is a little bit acidic. It's acidic because the honeybee enzymes, we didn't really talk about how honey is made. It's basically, you may not want to eat it after you find out, is, you know, the way they evaporate it from 80 to 90% water to 18% water is they suck it up, spit it out, suck it up, spit it out, suck it out over and over and over again 200, 300 times. And, yeah. And it gets mixed with bee saliva.
Uh-huh.
And the bee saliva contains an enzyme that converts one of the sugars called glucose into gluconic acid. And because it's a little more acidic, that helps the bees store the honey without promoting the growth of microbes. So it keeps it microbe-free. But it makes it a little more acidic, so you might want to add a little more baking soda, about 1/2 teaspoon per cup of honey, and that will cut down on the acidity.
Half a teaspoon?
More baking soda.
Baking soda.
Per cup of honey.
Per cup of honey. To neutralize the acidity.
Right, yeah. Unless you like a really kind of a sweet and sour kind of thing going on there. Some people can't. And it also depends on the honey as well, which varietal honey. The book, I make some recommendations, or some of the recipes come with recommendations for particular kinds of honey because their flavors are very complementary to the other ingredients.
In your book.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And because I would like people to make that realization that David made, that honey is not just one substance that, you know, like table sugar. Every crystal of sucrose is exactly the same as every other sucrose, at least as far as we can tell. But 1 tablespoon of honey can be very different, different color. When you bake with honey, because depending on the color of the honey, things tend to brown faster too. So that's
with
another.
The honey?
Yeah, when you cook with honey, because it already is. It, some of the agents make the batter darker to begin with. So.
Uh-huh.
So some people like to cook at a lower temperature.
Oh, so it might be a good idea to cook it at a lower temperature then?
Yeah. All of these tips are in the, yeah. Baked goods made with honey brown more quickly than those made with sugar should be cooked at lower temperatures.
Well, what, like 25 degrees, you think?
I think it depends on what else is in the recipe, but I'd say that would probably be a good start.
Might have to do some experimentation.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks
very much. And I think that it is true, certainly, I think within the last couple of years particularly, in looking at cooking magazines and seeing recipes, I think that there seems to be a lot more interest in varietal honeys and in doing just what you say, in taking a particular recipe and pairing a particular kind of honey and saying, because of its qualities, it's good with this, and a different kind is good with something else. So that's another thing. People might look for those kind of recipes and explore that. Another way to appreciate the differences between the various varieties of honey.
My mother used to make a honey cake at Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year's. And to me, honey cake just doesn't taste right unless buckwheat honey is used. And buckwheat honey is very popular in sort of the New York, Eastern European Jewish population. It's a very dark, very strong honey. And it just isn't honey cake without buckwheat honey.
Okay. Let's talk with somebody on cell phone, line two, right here. Hello.
Hi, I think you may have partially answered my question with your last response. I heard that some vegetarians don't eat honey.
Right.
And I think when you just described how honey is made, that will explain why. Because I was thinking it wasn't a protein, but if they suck it up and spit it out and suck it up, it's like a product of an animal. Is that it?
Actually, vegans do not eat honey. Some vegetarians will. But the main reason that vegans don't eat honey is that it's bee exploitation. Honest to gosh. And also, bees may die as a consequence of collecting honey. Good beekeeping practices mainly, you know, aim at keeping everybody alive, but accidents happen. So that's the main reason. But interestingly, according to the kosher laws, no insects are kosher except for grasshoppers and some crickets whose knees are above their feet. That's in the book of Leviticus. The only exception is the saltatorial or jumping hind legs of grasshoppers make them kosher. Nothing else is kosher. Bees are not kosher. But honey, the ancient Hebrews recognized that honey is not made from the bee, from within the bee. It is gathered and processed, just like we don't make bread. We gather grains and process the grains and make bread. And as a consequence, honey is kosher, always kosher. And it doesn't even need the blessing of a rabbi. Honey is always kosher. And it's the only product of a non-kosher animal that is itself kosher.
Oh, okay. Very interesting.
Even the, you know, it's honey is not like anything else. It is just an extraordinary substance.
All right.
Very interesting. Thanks.
Thank you. Let's continue. Then the next caller would be in Champaign on line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Hi.
Well, as a beekeeper and as an aside, I can assure the vegans that we mourn every bee accidentally crush on the way to get the honey. But I'm more interested in learning more about spiders, and I tuned in late, so maybe you've already gone over this, but I have this band of spiders in my house. Every room has a nice little web and this pale spider, and a couple of them hang out with me and help with the dishes and so on. And I don't see what they're catching, but under every web there's always these accumulation of carcasses and stuff, and I'm grateful for that. But they're pale and they're big, you know, maybe an inch or less when they're all spread out, and they have this tubular abdomen. And who are they? They're very
That's interesting. I was going to say, guess that they have sort of a messy, irregular web, not the beautiful orb, right? Because those tend to be cobweb spiders. The family Therodidae, the comb-footed spiders, and they do exactly as you say. They make these sort of messy corner webs and usually near light fixtures because lights attract. And usually, you know, when you empty out, you have to clean the light fixture. There are all these little, where do these bugs come from? Well, that's what the spiders are eating as well. But the tubular body, there's a different family, the Pholcids, which also make I'm not sure what they're called. Oh, daddy long legs. But do they have really long legs or not? Not so noticeably long.
Well, yeah, they do have long legs.
It might be a Pholcid, which is a – they're called daddy long legs spiders. They're not daddy long legs. That's a whole different animal. But they're long-legged spiders that make these sort of messy, cobwebby nests. Actually, if it is a Pholcid, they're very interesting because they also have been known to go into other spiders' webs and steal their prey. Other spiders will sort of paralyze a prey item and wrap it in silk for later. Right. The Pholcids will go into the web of another spider and snatch the already wrapped to-go prey. So.
Well, why not? After all. Yeah, these are, they're not very graceful. They sort of stumble around and they try to get out of your way, but occasionally they fall, you know.
Well, hey, if you had eight legs, think how hard it would be to coordinate. So.
Fulsids, huh? A fulsid.
Well, it's my guess. They're either cobweb spiders, Theridias, or fulsids. So.
Okay.
But if you go online, look under P-H-O-L-C-I-D and see if that's what it looks like. If not, try the comb-footed spiders.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
We have about five, six minutes left. I think probably every time we've talked in the last couple of years, we've probably talked about colony collapse disorder. And I want to make sure before we finish up here, I want to talk about it a little bit more because apparently there has been some new developments in the search for the explanation for what's going on.
It just gets stranger and stranger, actually. So the newest publication was a paper in the Public Library of Science, an open access journal, from a group based in Montana working with the U.S. Army using a new technique that actually looks for proteins rather than nucleic acids before the Israeli acute paralysis virus was found by a technique called metagenomics, where you use the honeybee genome to extract out the nucleic acid information that relates to honeybees, and then whatever's left over doesn't belong in a honeybee, and that's how they found this new virus. There's yet another new virus found on the basis of a peptide or protein fragment sequence called an invertebrate iridescent virus, IIV, and it's a DNA virus, not an RNA virus, so a different nucleic acid. It's not. There are other IIVs known from other insects. This one was had been described from a different species of bee several years ago. Investigators also found a new fungus. It's been here 15 years or so, Nosema serrani, which has long been suspected to play a role. And they suggest that the combination is deadly. But they didn't say that they'd solve the problem because they don't even have the virus isolated. They don't have the full sequence. They didn't fulfill the requirements for demonstrating a pathogen causes a disease, which means you have to find it in every infected individual, isolate it, and reinfect healthy individuals and then re-isolate that. That's the protocol, and they have not done that. And they admit that they didn't in the article, but if you read the publicity, you would think, you know, problem solved. Soldiers and scientists collaborate to solve the mystery. And I don't think anyone except whoever wrote that press release thinks the mystery is solved because there are so many gaps in that study. And then yet another interesting dimension, the lead author was criticized in Fortune magazine because he had accepted funding from Monsanto, from Bayer, which is a company that makes neonicotinoid insecticides, which are also suspected of contributing to colony collapse disorder. And the authors of this online article suggested that he therefore was conflicted and biased and compromised, even though the study had nothing to do with pesticides. But there are people who just believe that people are not studying pesticides because they're paid off by the chemical companies. It was a very tortuous argument. I didn't quite understand it, but it got a second round of publicity for this study.
So the bottom line is still no answer.
Still no consensus.
Yeah. I guess to me what's interesting, it gets at something. I think maybe it's a point that you've made, is that it may well be that it is a number of things coming together. It's not just one thing. It's some particular set of circumstances or things that are working together in some unforeseen and yet to be understood way.
We don't have an objective diagnostic. The way colony collapse disorder is diagnosed is basically by the number of missing bees. And, you know, there are some standards, but it's not a very – it's like trying to diagnose a human disease by how high your temperature goes. You know, it's just one symptomatic manifestation. We really need – a much better way to diagnose a disease is by looking for a particular antibody that shows you've been exposed to a pathogen. So we need that same sort of – objective diagnostic for colony collapse disorder, and we don't really have it.
We'll try real quick, get one more caller here, and that's Posodum, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Great show, as usual, or as always. I, a friend of mine has honeybee. I believe they're honeybees. They're small, look like honeybees in his house, and he wants to get them relocated.
Mm-hmm.
Is there someone that would try to capture these bees?
Actually, you can get in touch with Charlie Nye, who is the University of Illinois beekeeper, and he is well connected to the beekeeping community. And if there are beekeepers in search of colonies, actually they were in great demand during the summer. There was kind of a shortage of bees this summer. You can give him a call, and he might be able to connect you to a local beekeeper. I'm pretty sure his number is, I hope he doesn't mind giving.
Okay by me. It's okay by Charlie.
Well, I think
it would be in the staff book, so it's not like his number secret. So
that's true. Or I tell you what, you can send me an email, and I'll give you his number. It's I just don't have a priori permission. But,
that's fine. Is it NYE?
Exactly. And you can email me at maybe, MAYBE, first five letters of my name, at illinois.edu, and I can give you the number.
Great.
And thank you, by the way, for not just destroying
yesterday,
them.
Yesterday we were looking at those bees swarming around, and he didn't want to get rid of them, and I said instantly, I said, we got to get a hold of Mayberry. And then you were on today. So thanks
super.
So much.
Thank
I'll
you.
Let you guys go.
Thank you. Okay.
Appreciate all your work.
Well,
bye-bye.
There we pretty much got to wrap it up. May said earlier in the program, you know, two words that you're not going to find in one sentence are what, Mayberrynbaum and what? Do you say Mayberrynbaum, a cookbook?
Yeah.
I'm telling you, what you're going to find in the same sentence, Mayberrynbaum and sweet. That's it, ladies and gentlemen. She is the editor of a newly published book, Honey, I'm Homemade. It's a collection of recipes that all use honey. And also some information about bees and what they do and how they make honey. So if you're interested in bees and learning about that, if you like to cook, particularly if you like to bake, and you'd like to experiment with honey, this is the book that you should get. It's just recently out from the University of Illinois Press. And with folks who call in and make a pledge this morning of $75, we'll send you a copy, and May will sign it. And also, very special, this is the only place you're going to get this offer, folks. If you could make a $250 pledge, she says she would take you on a personal tour of the Pollinatarium, which they have set up here. Now, how long has it been going on? About 2 years, maybe?
2009 we opened.
Yeah.
So,
I think it's cool that it used to be a pesticide storage shed.
Sort of creative reuse there.
Exactly.
And karma.
Our also here in studio with me is our general manager for Illinois Public Media, Mark Leonard.
Well, thank you, David, and thank you, May. I'm thinking of bees in a whole different way now, which I guess is the point of this program, is bringing you deeper understandings of topics that you may not even know that you were interested in. But as always, I'm on the edge of my seat and thinking about bees and spiders in all sorts of new ways. If you would like to help to make this possible going into the future, continue to be possible, we'd love to sign you up as a member at 244-9455. We are in the last scheduled day of this membership campaign. We have an overall goal of $175,000, and we have crested $125,000. We stand right now at $125,898 raised. That's great. We're thankful for the current members and the people who have signed on, but we're not yet in the home stretch. We stand with $50,000 left to raise, and we'd like to be able to do it by the end of today. We have taken 29 calls of support during the last hour. We'd love to add your name to that list if you're not yet a supporter. Don't be a falsed spider living on somebody else's hard work. We'd like you to stand up and be counted by becoming a supporter. You know that this is non-commercial radio. This is a different format than commercial radio stations. That's why it sounds so different than every other station that you can listen to on the air. It's why we can bring you programs that are perhaps more thoughtful, more deep, more challenging. Deep content is something we talk about a lot here at WILL, and it's something that we do every single day on Focus. You're already a listener. You're already like WILL. Why not take the one additional step and help to make it possible with your financial support?
I hope you'll stick around. In the next hour, we'll have another nature topic for you. Michael Ward will be here. He's an avian ecologist with the Illinois Natural History Survey, and we'll be talking about birds.
Programs on WILL are made possible with support from Sinfonia da Camera, presenting Extraordinary Voices on Saturday, November 5th at 7:30 p.m. in the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Baritone Ricardo Herrera joins Sinfonia in a celebration of the works of William Schumann. More information is available at 333-6280.
Right now, we'll take a break for an update on the markets. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. Let's go right on out to the pits. And as we do that, we see that the markets are sharply higher today at mid-session. In Kansas City, December wheat is now 724 and a quarter, up 5 1/4. March, 739 and 3/4, up 5 1/4. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 680 and 3/4, up 10. December corn, 565 and a half, up 5 1/2. March, 580 and 3/4, up 8 1/2. July, 591 and a quarter, up 10 1/4. November beans, 1217, up 17 1/2. January, 1230, up 18 1/2. Go out to July, 1242, up 15 1/4. December soybean meal, 333.90, up $3. December soybean oil, 49.40, up $1.10. Now's the time to go to your phone and pledge for agriculture. 217-244-9455 is the number to call. We have a challenge on the board, $2,000 put together.